on this episode of Japan 2.0.
On November 25th, 1970, Mishima and four members of the Tate no Kai, under pretext, visited the commandant of the Japan Self-Defense Forces. Inside, they barricaded the office, tied up a commander to his chair with a prepared manifesto and a banner listing their commands. Mishima stepped onto the balcony to address the soldiers gathered below. His speech was intended to inspire a coup d'etat to restore the power of the emperor. He finished his speech after a few minutes, returning to the commander's office, and performed seppuku. The assisting members of the Tate no Kai were supposed to behead Mishima. His right-hand man attempted three times and failed. The second man had to step in and complete the deed. All right, so how do we get here? Who is Yukio Mishima? And as always, what can we learn about Japan through looking at the life of Yukio Mishima? Welcome to Japan 2.0. This is a series that I do sometimes. It's not a regular show, which is kind of Japan by or Japan through. We've done Japan through video games before. We looked at game series such as Persona and the Kashimaru Damashii series. I often will do Japan through fashion, where I looked at Americana-inspired company called Capital, and I've also looked at the kind of avant-garde punk rock company Undercover. And today, there's kind of a new subdivision of this kind of brand that we do, which is Japan by art, Japan through art, and this is about Yukio Mishima. So I first heard of Yukio Mishima through our friend of the show, Albert, actually. I heard the name before I lived here, and I knew him as just a writer, and I wasn't really familiar with any of his works. And Mishima is a pretty popular surname here, pretty common. So sometimes when I would hear the name thrown out there, I never really put two and two together. I knew that there was this political figure, Mishima, who was described to me as a nationalist, who personally, it doesn't really identify with the show's political beliefs. So I've never really was interested in hearing about nationalistic ideas. And then I would hear about the author, and then I heard about this guy who wanted to bring back the samurai, was a bodybuilder who would often pose naked. Yeah, and I never knew that all three of these Mishimas, these different kind of windows in this man, were all the same person. I thought they were all different people. And it wasn't until I went to a show, and these are the musicians who are bringing you the music for today's show, of a group called the Seppuku Pistols with Albert. And I really loved the band, and it was just a really great time, and I'm sure you'll be able to hear it's a great blending of, you know, punk and traditional Japanese music. And they were selling t-shirts there, and I was like, man, this is great. I want to support this band and buy one of these t-shirts. And Albert was like, oh, you might want to do your research a bit about the guy on that shirt before you're going to maybe support those ideas. Yeah, and it just had like a really kind of cool, very low, like hand-drawn picture of Mishima on it, his likeliness on there. And yeah, I'm pretty glad Albert told me that, because I mean, I think for me, Mishima is like fascinating figure, not only like in Japan, but in the world. I think he's one of the most fascinating people to live in modern times. He died in 1970. So we're looking at about 48 years ago. Yeah, I think it was the most fascinating people to be alive in the last 50 years. I just wish I could agree I wish I could disagree with some of the things he said more, because I strongly disagree with pretty much most of what he thinks, but his way of doing things to me is quite inspirational. And a lot of times when we do these shows, we kind of come at you with answers or things, but I'm definitely not a Mishima expert. I'm still, after living for 5 years here, I mean, he's put out around 40 works total, and he's just written a lot. And I've only ever read Confessions of a Mask, actually, in this week to get ready for this show, which is the most people say the most autobiographical of his work. That's part of the reason I read it. I also am a big fan of a film by Paul Schrader, who did Taxi Driver. You may know him from Taxi Driver, called Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters. So those are some of the main sources I'm kind of basing my information on here for this show. But yeah, I guess I'm more asking questions, and we've been getting a bigger community lately for our show. So I'm going to kind of put this one in the community's hands. You know, if people are more interested in this, or they have kind of takes and answers, and maybe I'll kind of synthesize those and do like a follow-up episode to this. Kind of learning from our community out there about Mishima, because there are a lot of Mishima experts. Like I said, one of the most fascinating figures. People consider him one of the greatest modern writers in the last 100 years, not only for conservative Japan, but even like homosexual or gay literature. He was considered like kind of on the forefront of that in the last 100 years. So yeah, there's a lot of scholars of him, and I'm not one, but I'm very interested in the man. If I haven't grabbed your attention already, hopefully we're going to kind of go back now to the beginning. That was obviously the last day of his life, was a botched beheading and seppuku performance at the self-defense force yard, which is insane. So how did this man get to that point, and how does he become this big figure? He was born in 1925 in Shinjuku. His dad was a government official, and his mom's family came from samurai lineage, which you'll see followed him to the end of his life. He's actually raised primarily by his grandma until the age of 12. I'm not quite sure why. I've tried reading up on why that is. Maybe his parents are just very busy, and it's not abnormal here to have grandparents take care of you. But his grandma seems to be very strict. She was, you know, was on the mom's side, so this is the grandma on the mom's side, who was had the real, you know, kind of aristocratic samurai lineage, and she definitely, from what I read, was pushing that on him at a very young age. She wouldn't allow him to go outside. She didn't allow him to go to normal school. He went to kind of like an art-based school. He was only allowed to play with his female cousins, primarily. A lot of times, cited playing like dolls or traditional, kind of like theater-based dolls. And it was around the age of 12 that he returned back to his immediate family, living with his dad and his mom. His dad was apparently very militant on him. He didn't like any effeminate qualities at all. And I guess, as I'll kind of get into later, one of Yukio's main things he would write about, he was very interested in exploring sexuality. And I guess his dad found early remnants of that, those kind of tendencies, and he would try to squash them. There's this famous story about him being tied to a train, like the outside of a train, as a form of punishment and discipline, and trying to turn him into a quote-unquote man. His grandma was one of the ones who really was pushing him to go to this prestigious kind of art school. And at the age of 12, or right around the age of 12, he was put on this literary board, which was the youngest they had ever had at the school, a member of the literary board at the age of 12. And he's mostly at the time writing poetry. And that was kind of like his merit, I guess, for getting on this literary board. One of his first kind of well-renowned works, again, shortly after 12, is a short story called Forest in Full Bloom. And it's a story about a protagonist. And again, a lot of Mishima's work, the protagonists are considered to be very derivative of him himself. And this protagonist in Forest in Full Bloom is a character who has the spirit of his ancestors kind of living inside of him and trying to deal with that. Characteristics of the short story were a lot of like idioms, kind of just general like life phrases, like making things up, not like repeating famous idioms, but like creating his own, and really deep and kind of extended metaphors and allegories. So that was young, like I said, right around 12. And these are big trademarks of his in his most seminal important works later in his life as well. So I think people throw out the word like genius and prodigy and stuff, but I think he was bordering on that for sure. He kind of gets to like the next step in his life a couple years later, around the age of 18. He fails his military exam. Now, again, I've not been able to find he himself how much of a nationalistic, strong conservative he was at a young age, although that kind of family conservative, highbrow aristocracy definitely seems to be a theme in his work. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're a national, though, if you're nationalist, if you're following those. But he definitely was into his emperor and the military at the time. This is around the time of World War II. And yeah, serving for your emperor, you know, was a huge honor. The emperor at that time, this is a point of contention and an important point in Mishima's story, was actually considered a god. And yeah, to not serve your god, you know, for someone who follows a certain creed or religion, you know, is a bad thing to do. So the importance of this is he fails a military exam. Now, I've seen conflicting reports on this. In the film, which is highly regarded as being accurate and not romanticizing too much, Mishima, Life in Four Chapters, it has him kind of like exaggerating like his sickness, like how long he has a cough for, to the like examiner, the doctor who's having him do like a cough check. And the doctor asks him, like, do you get long fits of coughs for a while, and do you see blood when you cough? And he answers yes. So they don't allow him in the military to do that. In which then right after he like regrets and has this huge regret, other reports just say he generally failed it, and it was the doctor's fault. It was like a new doctor. That doctor was shortly fired after, and it was just like an erroneous test. Needless to say, he was known for being very weak as an adolescent and pretty sickly. Like I was saying before, he wasn't allowed to go outside very often, bullied in school. So conflicting reports there why he didn't join the military. Although I would say if he did at all purposely fail the exam, it doesn't really go with everything else we know about him. But who knows? Maybe he was still young then and just got scared, as any human would. So all his kind of peers go off to war, and as it was a, you know, a long, violent, famously documented war, most of his friends died. And I think he felt at that point for sure like he wasn't living life's mission to serve his emperor. And somehow, like, why is he still alive? He felt punished almost for being alive. Goes on after the war to write Confessions of a Mask. Like I said before, this is the only work of his that I've personally read. And like most autobiographical, it's said to be, especially the first half of the book. I'll just tell you a little bit about it, because a lot of times people say, if you're going to start in Mishima, this is the book to read. The protagonist's name is Kochan, and he... Mishima's a pen name, by the way. So Kochan is like a short for his... actual name, Kimitake. And so that's why it's like, yeah, this is probably him. Raised during like a right-wing kind of family with imperialism, and he just is struggling to fit into society at a very young age, like Mishima. This character is also kind of a weak body, made fun of for his body, and really talks a lot about his body and struggles. Doesn't fit into society, and goes through sexual struggles as well, and homosexual desires and urges. So he wasn't allowed to be around boys because his family kind of knew about this growing up. Again, you know, as I said, the fact is Mishima wasn't allowed to play with boys and was forced to play with his cousins who were female. So yeah, a lot of parallels there. It goes a lot through the characters like frustrations and fantasies within his head, always themes of death and violence and yeah, kind of introspection. So really interesting book, again, especially when you consider the time that it came out. There was no one else writing about some of those topics, and if you kind of, for me, like, I don't know, I personally can't separate the man from his works, and I think he's like a fascinating human. Again, disagreeing with most of what he says, I'll get into kind of why later, but he's really someone who took art and made it his own life. He couldn't just write about it or fictionalize it. He kind of viewed himself and his body as a piece of art as well. And as someone who's interested in all facets of art and design, you know, I think that's someone who really loved their craft. Moving on, about 6 years later in 1956, 7 years later, he writes another seminal work, important piece called Temple of the Golden Pavilion. This one's about the famous Golden Temple in Kyoto. It's based off true events. It's not entirely factual, but basically there was a young Buddhist acolyte in 1950 in real life who burnt down. I'm not sure how successful or if it was completely burnt down. Golden Temple is definitely there today, but I do believe it is rebuilt. And it was a pretty big shock to Japan at the time because that pavilion had survived the war and bombings. And then just shortly after be destroyed by a Buddhist in training, would be pretty crazy. So it was a pretty big shock to Japan. So the book is based on that. Again, there's parallels with Mishima himself. The main character is very weak. He has a stutter. Mishima did not have a stutter, but the character in Golden Pavilion does. And he meets a guy who has a limp. And the limp guy is trying to teach him to have his way with women and to play up your disabilities to get girls. And throughout this, and he overcomes his stutter as well once he gets more confident with women. And then it's about destroying something. There can't be something so beautiful in this world, and we have to destroy what's beautiful, which is the Golden Pavilion. So those are two of his more famous works. I'll take a break, and I'll kind of come back with a bit more of Mishima's personal life, the man behind the work. Okay, so it was around this time that Mishima's starting to reach international acclaim. He kind of didn't really view himself a success. He wanted to get really published in English and become big in North America. And he eventually did. He became friends with a lot of Western authors and, you know, was this kind of big figure. And, it was seen to really represent Japan. He spoke pretty solid English, especially for the time. So he definitely represented Japan in a lot of ways. And I think from my understanding, this is kind of where he took the opportunity to become a political activist a bit, or at least be a little more preachy and, you know, say his ideas to people. And I don't think people knew much otherwise. I think people were fairly ignorant to what was actually happening in Japan or what actual Japanese culture was at the time, as it wasn't that far after the war. And I guess he becomes more aware of his kind of self-image at this point. So 1955, right around the writing of the Golden Pavilion, he starts getting super into bodybuilding and weight training. And has this kind of famous workout session where he worked for just three times per week, but for 15 years straight. Whatever it was Monday, Wednesday, Friday. He just kept to that for 15 years and would really not let anything get in his way. He wrote a book really about his relationship. I'm going to read kind of a film analysis, like a movie director who talks about this. Sun in the Steel is the name of this work. So if you're really into physical health and bodybuilding, this might be the Mishima work for you. I'm going to end the podcast with kind of a reading about that. But talks all about the mind over the body versus body over the mind. And that's kind of the big debate in that book. After that book, he gets really into kendo, which is traditional Japanese swordsmanship, a sport. He almost, talking about his personal life a bit, he almost gets married to this lady with the surname Shoda. and she, it doesn't work out between them, and she goes on to actually eventually marry the prince Akihito, which is crazy. So she becomes an empress. So she could have married Mishima or a prince. She went with the prince. He does eventually get married to a girl named Sugiyama, and that was in 1958. So just after the whole bodybuilding, you know, he's super buff. If you've never seen photos of him, maybe I'll put some up on our podcast feed throughout the week. But if not, just look him up. He's like, he's pretty ripped. He's pretty big. And there's some really hilarious photos of him. There's this one for a really awesomely named magazine. I think it's called like Samurai Bodybuilding Magazine. I've looked it up. It sells for like $250 now. I would like to have it. Of him just like wearing a loincloth and holding a samurai sword, and that's it, and just being buff and doing crazy poses. The images of him are pretty insane, just the way he posed, and he becomes this kind of larger than life figure. He got into acting and he sang theme songs for TV shows at the time, so he's huge. Like, he's a giant celebrity, like, you know, most famous author. He's nominated for literature awards very often, but never actually won any of the major ones. And so he's married and ends up having two kids. Sorry, got off on a bit of a tangent there. But this is kind of like where his, people who are interested in his sexual orientation. Obviously, he's written about gay characters before, but he's never come out and really confirmed it. He wrote other books that are really, one's called Forbidden Colors, in which he was like, claimed that his wife, he was doing like work for the book to go like the gay bar district in Shinjuku. It's come out since then that like people he was hanging out with at the time said that they were like his gay lovers. In 1998, the family actually sued those people for coming out and saying that, and they actually won, saying it was, you know, hurting Mishima's image. So it's much debated. If you care about that, you can do a lot of reading on that line. I'm sure find something out. I don't know. For me, it's not really important. I mean, it's cool he's writing about those issues. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of people could relate to that at the time. But whether he himself was or not, I don't know. It's all part of the mystique of Mishima for me. Kind of getting to the end of what he's notable for. So in 1967, 3 years before he commits suicide, he enlists in the self-defense force, which after the war, Japan doesn't have a military anymore. They just have like a defense force, and it's just to kind of protect themselves, you know. But there's no, like, as far as I know at that time, there was no tanks or planes or anything. It's pretty, you know, for first world countries, it was incredibly passive. So Mishima joins them after failing the military test years before. So Mishima undergoes basic training. They make him do basic training like everyone else, which is insane, right? I just got done establishing how famous he was, how world-renowned he was. And, here he is doing basic training. Apparently, he becomes nationalistic really towards the end of his life and extremely conservative. He forms a group I kind of mentioned at the beginning, the Tate no Kai, which that means like Shield Society, which was a private militia. Mainly he would get these kind of young students, and they would advertise for them in like university magazines. And the big thing they pushed were physical discipline and protecting the Emperor of Japan, who he later renounces because after World War II, I guess part of Japan losing was that the Emperor had to say like he wasn't a god anymore. There was some stipulation there. And Mishima and a lot of conservatives really were against this idea. So Hirohito is the emperor at the time, and basically later goes on to kind of denounce him. But I guess in the beginning of times, you know, they really want to like bring back the power of the emperor. Mishima, I believe there's only around 100 people at the height when Mishima was the leader, and he trained everyone individually to get like his ideology across. Also with him, he wants to bring back the Bushido, the samurai code. He's doing this right around the time he joins the self-defense force. Apparently he was kind of a joke. I think it's also fascinating that the self-defense force let Mishima join. maybe just because of his kind of international acclaim and power. But yeah, I mean, that's where things, you know, start getting pretty weird. I think it kind of started with the bodybuilding, the obsession with the body. And then he goes on and commits, you know, the seppuku, the coup d'etat that I talked about at the beginning of the episode. And he basically, like, always talked about suicide, right? I mentioned during the war when his friends were dying, he felt he should die too. All his works and books were kind of glorifying dying for what you believe in and taking your own life. So he knew, you know, I think he knew this coup d'etat was going to fail based on his biographer. John Nathan has pretty much said, like, yeah, he knew it was a suicide, and he just thought he would kind of do it in style and, yeah, be art, right? Like, that's kind of the thing, I think, with Mishima as we're getting to the end here. Imitating life, imitating art, or, you know, is it the other way around? I think this final act, in my opinion, from what I know about him, was like truly what he believed in, and to die doing what he believed in politically, ideology, that's, yeah, that was his way to go, his way to do it, kind of at the height of his fame too. He had left affairs to his families beforehand, so he knew. It was very meditated. They said for about a year he was planning it. He had just completed his book, his final book, Sea of Fertility. It's a tetralogy. And, yeah, kind of like his legacy, he's one of the most famous modern Japanese writers. He wrote 34 novels, 50 plays, 25 short stories. So there you go. I kind of just want to end with, in the Criterion version of Mishima Life in Four Chapters, there's a really great book it comes with a bunch of essays, and this one's by a guy named Kevin Jackson, and I'm just going to kind of read some excerpts from him, but basically he's really comparing him to Oscar Wilde, another famous Western author who was very much kind of about the body and using your body as art. Oscar Wilde, kind of that was like a phase for him, though, and eventually kind of gets overweight and doesn't stick with his ideals, where Mishima is the opposite of that. Mishima spent hours turning this kind of sickly, scrawny guy into this powerful muscle man. He took strange, extreme political ideas, brought them into action, whether you agree with them or not. He was a man of his own word. He didn't agree with what the military was doing, so he made his own private army, became the general. He composed the final act of his life in his head, thought about it, kind of wrote about a lot of these things, and then he does it with his own blood, with a samurai sword. I think these acts are kind of repelling and strange, but you can't deny that he had control over his own life, and he, you know, died doing fully what he believed in. So what do you think about Yukio Mishima? Can you overlook his political ideals and just appreciate the art? Do you think he's an important figure in Japan and modern history? For me, he kind of helps me understand the whole suicide aspect of Japan. I mean, suicide and Japan are something that are well known or often placed together. And living here today isn't something I really hear people talking about. I haven't heard about people committing suicide. It's, you know, very similar to how it would be, you know, living in America where I grew up. But I guess knowing about Mishima kind of helps me in the way he wrote about it and during the time of the war and how it was quite common then. And the idea of serving for the emperor, who was a god, kind of helped me understand it, you know, where it comes from and how it's kind of deeply ingrained in this culture, you know, where Western cultures maybe wouldn't have it as ingrained, you know. It was never a time where it was really glorified as much as here. So I think that's, you know, a kind of interesting aspect of Mishima. I think, like, yeah, sexuality in general, how Japan treats it. You can learn a lot about that through Mishima as well. So like I said, this episode for me is kind of more about just kind of raising some questions or wondering what you guys think about Mishima, or if you've never heard of him, yeah, check him out. I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg. It's about a 30-minute podcast. I would recommend Confessions of a Mask or A Life in Four Chapters, the Criterion film, as good places to start. Yeah, read some of his work. I have these ebbs and flows where I'll just kind of be interested in them and read a little bit more. I've been going through one of those myself lately where he's been kind of coming up in my radar again. And I just thought I'd take the time to tell you guys a little bit about him. So we're Japan 2.0, in case you don't know. We're all over the internet. We post a lot on Instagram these days. We got a Facebook and Twitter too. If you could give us a review on iTunes, that's one of the most helpful things. We've kind of been getting a lot of people lately asking us about Patreon, if we're doing one. We don't really have any short-term plans to do that, but if you wanted to take the time to do something to help us out instead of paying us, you could just write a review on iTunes, because that just gives the show more kind of attention. So yeah, look forward to a new episode soon. Matt and I are meeting up next weekend. We're going to record some kind of classic episodes for you guys. So until next time, thanks for listening.